Welcome to episode 5 of History's Hotties, the podcast that discusses the influential but sometimes overlooked women in American history, and I am your host, Krista. First, I would like to thank our subscribers. I'm really excited to see how many new subscribers have been added every single day. Also, I am aware of the sound issues from the last couple of episodes. My husband and I are working on the technical difficulties with my recording equipment, as well as the volume, so hopefully this episode will be a bit better. I will be making a big announcement at the end of the show, so stay tuned until then. I would also like to announce that we have begun a Facebook page. All episode titles and a brief description are available there, so if you go to History's Hotties, that's H-I-S-T-O-R-Y apostrophe S, H-O-T-T-I-E-S, on Facebook, it should take you straight to our page. This will be the first part in a two-part podcast entitled What Harriet Jacobs Taught Us About Slavery. The topic of slavery really could be its own podcast, and to study an individual slave, I believe, is always helpful in putting the story of slavery into context. In our history textbooks, we learned about a few heroic slaves and former slaves who risked their lives for freedom in ways that really demand respect and admiration. But what is even more interesting to me when we hear about individual slaves is that we hear names like Harriet Tubman, a woman, who was written about just about as much as men like Frederick Douglass. When we watch movies or read books about the slave, we read that there were house slaves and field slaves. The children of a master were often allowed to become house slaves, making their workload a little bit easier. As if somehow this is ironic, it should lessen the guilt of a master who seems to ignore the fact that he is enslaving his own flesh and blood. While other slaves worked really in terrible conditions in the field, including pregnant women, causing an even higher death rate among their infants than their white counterparts. Those slaves could not marry. They often celebrated with ceremonies, and sometimes masters would allow a minister to perform a ceremony. However, after the war, when white society began to demand the former slave couples marry, some resistance really surfaced on the other side, where black women refused to marry. If you read the leading historians on the subject, you do see some varying evidence that show differing statistics and trends depending on the type of slave, the family they belonged to, the background, and how they were treated, and whether or not they had free relatives in the North. As to whether or not they wanted to get married or they wanted to avoid the institution altogether. I have read that slaves were most often split up if they were willed to relatives for quick cash to save a failing plantation or if they were considered a problem, while others say that slaves were sold on almost a yearly basis based solely on their production levels. So I think my conclusion for all of these things is that all of these trends existed. None were any less terrible for the slave, and it only supports, again, the cruelty of the master-slave relationship, where the personal for one was the political and business interest of another. So this is the sort of the background of slavery that we hear a lot in our textbooks, that is the sort of the common background of slavery that a lot of people know. Women were at the center of the slave family because it was so rare that a father was still around, and often the father of a slave woman's child was not actually her owner. It was a man that was chosen for her, sort of studded out male slaves and female slaves that could be paired together in a house, and they were forced to have children. Northern leaders encouraged former slave women to adopt a role of the traditional housewife, as did many former slave men. This kind of created a twofold problem because, one, few black slaves could afford to survive without the woman working, though many tried, especially those still in the South who did not want their wife to enter into field labor again. This really angered plantation owners and created real cultural problems in the black community, where women were refusing to acquiesce to the demands of their husbands as well. They were adverse to anyone telling them what to do and how to live. So they were, they were fighting the former master, and they were fighting sometimes their husband's authority. There were, however, some that reveled in being able to create a more traditional family that had really thrived and wanted to have that free life that they saw the white families around them have, which I said before really chapped the hides of the plantation owners who lost half their field working population. According to Sarah Evans in Born for Liberty, the gender roles in Afro-American families were far more equal than in white society, and monogamy was expected and self-regulated in their kinship and living circles, which was probably a twofold reaction. The first was the desire to have family ties in a society where families were sold and separated really with little thought, and also as a reaction to the poor behavior in the paternalistic white society, which has always surprised me that the suppressed population adopted some of the social patterns that often put their master's own unspoken and hidden behavior to shame. And they took it and embraced morals that their masters didn't show at all. Women were often the reformers, often begun in the church environment, and this gave women a place to meet and organize that was not considered out of the appropriate realm for women. We're back again to Catherine Beecher and the cult of domesticity in the 19th century, which is one of the reasons that I covered her first, because we really see this theme throughout American history. Many white Christian women in the North saw slavery as an example of the vices of men in their lust for power and sex and money, and emphasizing the womanly virtue at the same time. While we see later that the normal plantation mistress did not exactly fit the role of Scarlet, I'm using my quote fingers, and sometimes considered slavery a scourge to polite society, most certainly did not believe that these people owned by their family were of equal value in society. We will discuss this more when we talk about the myth of Scarlet in a later podcast. So this kind of goes over, I have now gone over background about slavery in general, morals at the time, and kind of some trends in what slaves and former slaves wanted for their own families, which all are pertinent to our podcast topic today. So today we are going to talk about some less common trends in slavery. There were slaves that lived in the few cities of the South who had somewhat of a different existence than what I've told you here. Their morals and their desires were often the same, but maybe not living on the plantation used for field labor traded on a yearly basis. They lived just a different life. Some scholars break slaves into two categories: those who were slaves in the Upper South versus those in the Deep South, where there were few cities and a longer distance to flee if the opportunity to go north presented itself. While most people believe that slaves were really rarely allowed to leave their plantation or the home of their master, there were reasons that some were allowed to leave, and this always opened the door for either truancy, where a slave would leave for a while and return after the heavy harvest season, or if another slave had assured them by secret message that they wouldn't be whipped, or if they were close to being found. Men who were more likely to have a skill were often allowed to leave to be hired out in exchange for, say, a portion of their pay going to the master, or in an exchange for keeping up their own family. This might entail a pass to go from one plantation to another or to a nearby town, and this gave the slave the opportunity to kind of make out the lay of the land, learning where to hide and the patterns of the armed men who searched for escaped slaves. When slaves returned to their plantation, it was not always because of violence or capture, but sometimes to return to families or because they were starving and cold. What was really surprising to me when I began researching this topic several years ago was the likelihood of a woman truant being punished more harshly than a man. According to Stephanie Camp, and I could not stay there, it's an essay that has been published regarding the topic of slavery, men were more likely to be forgiven for their escape attempts or absences than women, and masters used all sorts of creative methods for punishment. And Camp actually says sadistic ways to punish women for their escapes. I've read several different discussions about this topic, and the general agreement is that masters were more afraid of the general uprisings from male slaves, and that punishing females emasculated the male slave counterparts even further, in addition to this paternalistic attitude of masters that was prevalent in every decision made by masters in the slave-owning South. Slaves that lived in the city often had even more freedom of movement than the plantation slaves with passes. A lot of them were hired out to work in local tradesmen shops or to offer services such as sewing or baking to other people. In addition to this, these slaves were often more exposed to former slaves that had been freed but were unwilling to leave the South because of a deep desire to stay near their still enslaved family members. And in fact, in addition to Harriet Jacobs' description in her wanted poster, it was noted that she was a quote, she was, quote, a good seamstress and therefore dressed well, lest an escaped slave attempted to use a skill they might have learned to survive on their journey north. Slaves in cities might work in a factory beside free blacks and poor whites, and often the factory owners who owned them would allow them to procure their own housing, again making the only barrier between these workers and freedom the bands of bounty hunters that roamed all the trails heading north looking for the rewards for escaped slaves. So many southern whites were concerned about urban slaves more than any other group of slaves. Even when you had large bands of several hundred slaves on a plantation, these urban slaves were a source of fear for some people. Now, how do all these things relate to this week's podcast? Harriet Jacobs was a slave woman who was born on a plantation in Edenton, North Carolina in 1813. Her father was mixed race and actually hired out as a carpenter in exchange for a $200 yearly stipend that he paid to his owner for his and his family's upkeep. And her mother was Delilah Horniblow, who was owned by a tavern owner who had actually Delilah had actually been freed as a child during the Revolutionary War and then recaptured when her mother and two siblings were traveling, sold back into slavery, and then she had Harriet while she was a slave. Delilah died when Harriet was 6 years old, after which Harriet lived with her mistress, Margaret Horniblow. I suppose that many of you have noticed that the slaves we're discussing are addressed by the same surname as their master. I do not know why Harriet Jacobs was not did not have the same name as Dr. Norcom, her later master. But she did not. She went by Harriet Jacobs, which I'm assuming could have been the last name of her grandmother. I assume that most of you, by the way, if any of the readers know why, please let me know. I would love to know that. I assume that most of you already understood the custom of last names, but if you did not, slaves were addressed this way, and many of them actually kept these names after the Civil War if they did not choose a different surname. Margaret Horniblow was a compassionate woman who was kind to Harriet and taught her how to read and write and sew. It was illegal to teach a slave to read and write, so we have very few firsthand accounts of slave life, which really makes this book a treasure trove of information, and really just that firsthand account is so amazing to read. But when Margaret died, she willed Harriet to her 5-year-old niece, Mary Matilda Norcom, and this is where our story really begins. Harriet used the name Linda Brent when writing her story, which was first published in the New York Tribune in a series. But this really shocked the average reader with the specific and graphic accounts of sexual exploitation and violence that was going on in the South. These people had been somewhat unwilling to believe and understand just how appalling the life of a slave was. Phillips and Sampson Publishing House would only publish the full manuscript if an author named Nathaniel Parker Willis, or possibly Harriet Beecher Stowe, we see another connection to Catherine Beecher here, would write a foreword, but Harriet did not want to ask Willis, and Stowe actually declined the offer. Harriet then signed a deal with Thayer and Eldridge, with a foreword written by Lydia Marie Child, but when Thayer and Eldridge went bankrupt, another company finally published it. Harriet changed the names of all the people in her manuscript as well, including her own, even protecting the name of her former master, certainly out of fear for her life, as well as that of her relatives, both free and slave, that still lived within walking distance of Dr. Norcom and his son, who he had really raised to be as cruel as him. Certainly a smart move at the time, considering it was 1861 when the book was published. published. The foreword written by actually Harriet. Harriet writes a foreword, and then Lydia Marie Child writes a foreword. But Harriet's foreword asks forgiveness from her readers for the graphic nature of the story. And she asserts that her motive is only to educate and not offend. And the foreword written by Child says that while Harriet's white employers, I'm using quote fingers again, highly esteemed Harriet out of a need to attest to Harriet's character and the veracity of the accounts given in the book. It was assumed at the time that all people of Harriet's race were capable of being liars, and so it was necessary to attest to the character of someone before a white person might believe her account, which is really sad. This is the first thing the reader sees, and I do think it speaks volumes. Child became a lifelong friend of Harriet's after their time working together on the manuscript. Neither of these women was unaware of how this book would be received in many circles, both in the North and the South. Like I said before, the beating and raping of a female stung the sensibilities of middle-class women in the North. Even though they were well aware of slavery's existence, they were just ignorant about it, and so this wasn't something discussed in polite society. Even those who knew that abuse occurred just chose to ignore how heinous the abuse could become. But the reason I believe Harriet Jacobs' story is not just another story filled with the abuse that we all know occurred, even if many times it was ignored, she tells a side to the story of a slave that is so detailed and different from those of other slaves, and she tells it in her own voice, that she becomes a phenomenal source for research and study. Not to mention how clever and brave she was to outwit her master, which we will see later. Many of the details of Harriet's life that she did not feel safe to share in her book were derived from letters Harriet wrote to a Quaker friend named Amy Post, such as, you know, details about who her master actually was, who actually fathered her children, who her grandmother was, where she lived, all of these things. In addition to this, the first edition of Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl did not list Linda Brent as the author, of course, Harriet's nom de plume, but only Child as the editor on the title page. So it just goes to show you the lengths that Harriet went to protect herself and her children and her relatives. Harriet and her brother both belonged to who we know now is a Dr. Norcombe, and gives detailed accounts of his treatment of all of his slaves, from starving them to beating them, but states that from an early age the doctor took an interest in her, which greatly concerned her grandmother, a free woman named Molly who baked goods for the fellow townspeople. She was a freed slave, and she was attempting with her business to save up and buy freedom for her children and grandchildren. And interestingly enough, Harriet also says that her grandmother was beloved by many of those townspeople who had grown to respect her over the years, not only because she had nursed many of them as babies, but because of her personal conduct. One actual example of this respect happened after the Nat Turner Revolt, when slaveholders and a group of angry farmers cracked down in a reign of terror over pretty much every African American in the South. When the group searching the residences of any and every black person got to Molly's house and began to rummage through her belongings, a white neighbor entered the house to observe. Many of Harriet's letters were discovered during this search, but no real actions were taken against either her or her grandmother. How these people really felt about the grandmother, you know, whether what the motive was of this white neighbor who came in to watch this group of marauders who came in this house, really felt, we will never know. But Harriet seems so keenly aware of the origins of hatred for the slave race from their masters, it would make sense that she could identify when one of them was not being treated the same as others, and she felt like her grandmother maybe was treated a little differently. Harriet's mistress was also aware of the interest that I said Dr. Norcombe had taken in Harriet when Harriet was young, as were many of the wives in the slaveholding South. We will discuss this side of the story when we cover the myth of Scarlet in a later podcast. But for now, we will mostly talk about how these women took their anger out on the slave woman when they noticed any kind of interest their husband was showing in a slave woman. We have to remember that a wife in this period had few rights, as well as few ways to earn her own living, as we discussed again in the first two episodes about Catherine Beecher, who was looking for a way to support herself. So these wives were beholden to her father and then to her husband, who were living in almost a psychological microcosm where the ability to just control other humans ran amok and manifested itself into this paternalistic dictatorship in almost every home, where men acted with little or no consequence, and many used this as an excuse to act on every feeling of rage and selfishness, hoping to keep everyone in their place, subordinate to the master, whether it be wife, child, or slave. So when Harriet turned 15, Dr. Norcombe, who already had an interest in her, whose wife was already aware of this interest, began to sexually harass Harriet, even though other people in town offered to buy her, seeing that she was an intelligent girl and believed that she would be a good servant. He would say that she belonged to his daughter, Mary Matilda, and that he could not sell her, even after the daughter died a few years later, in an attempt to keep Harriet close and to wear her down in submitting to him. Not only did Harriet wish to live up to the expectations of her free grandmother and avoid making herself a man's object, she was keenly aware of how Dr. Norcombe handled his former lovers. He would sell them, and a lot of times would sell the children he had fathered to a different owner than the mother. This differs a bit from some other masters who would allow their children, their slave children, to play alongside their white children, and then the slave children would go to work when they were old enough. Sometimes you would see a father free his own offspring, sometimes, or allow them to be house slaves who were better fed, but you certainly didn't see these children treated like a part of the family. And because their mothers were slaves, the children were automatically slaves. The status of the child followed the status of the mother. Dr. Norcombe was a bit afraid of Harriet's grandmother because she did do business with many of the white women in town, and gossip can really be a killer, we know that. This held off some of his more aggressive advances for a while, but he tried all sorts of things, like saying he was going to stay in his own apartments in his large house separate from his wife, and that Mary Matilda would go with him, and so Harriet needed to go with them to take care of the little girl. Needless to say, this was not Mrs. Norcombe's first rodeo with this. So she would nag her husband, but when this didn't give her any satisfaction, she began to publicly accuse Harriet of behaving in a way that would allure Dr. Norcombe, including to accusing Harriet to Harriet's own grandmother. Harriet actually, when she writes a chapter where she shows a bit of sympathy for the northern girls who marry these slave owners who don't grow up in this system because they are unaware of the systematic use of slave women for sexual slaves as well. She says that many of them become really just shells of their former selves when they realize their husband already has children littered all over his property, and begins to see slave children belonging to their husbands that are the same age as their own children, so they know their husband is sleeping with them and then immediately going out and sleeping with these slave women, that there's no, it doesn't even move up and down in periods of time in their marriage. It's all the time for many of these slaveholders. So when Dr. Norcombe would speak to Harriet, he would tell her he intended to protect her and would, and actually he began building a cabin for her on the outskirts of town so that she could, I'm using my quote fingers, have her own house. But of course his intent was to get her out from under his wife's claws, who had now taken notice of what was going on, and to make his actions private. So when the doctor learns that Harriet, and actually when the doctor learns that Harriet loves a former slave who is a carpenter in town, he begins to attack him verbally and threatens that he will never free her or allow the man to buy her, no matter how much the offer. And during all this, Harriet is suffering from Dr. Norcombe's harassment. She's got this man that she loves who now she knows can never buy her. And at the same time, the wife is threatening her. The wife actually showed up in her room a couple of nights, and would lean over Harriet and talk to her and say things to her when she believed Harriet was asleep, and then would, because she wanted to listen to see if Harriet said anything in her sleep that might give her away, that perhaps possibly Harriet was already sleeping with Dr. Norcom. And then when Harriet would wake up, she would say, "You are talking in your sleep." Harriet was well aware that this was happening and talks about it in the book, and of course she never gave anything away because there was nothing going on to give away. And I don't, the mistress, of course, assumed that Harriet was simple, not very smart, and therefore would certainly give herself away eventually. Apparently, she had no idea of just how clever Harriet really was. So Harriet is resisting at every turn, pretending that she didn't understand Dr. Norcom when he would make these sexual advances at her, and then asserting when she acted like she had figured it out that he was asking her to sin, even though she knew all along what he was saying. When the pressure finally becomes too difficult to bear, Harriet takes a calculated risk, and she takes Samuel Sawyer, a white lawyer who eventually becomes a member of the U.S. House of Representatives, as a consensual lover. She talks about him. She talks about how kind he is. She talks about how he was a single man, so she didn't feel like she was ruining a marriage or making some other woman miserable because he didn't have a wife that would become hurt by her actions. So she's really thinking about how she's going to handle this. What can she do to get herself out of the situation that she's been put in by no fault of her own? When she becomes pregnant, she tells her grandmother, who at first really does not take the news well, and then she tells her master, who was brutal and flew into a rage. Harriet knew that while Dr. Norcom had power over another slave or free black man, her relationship with another white man would protect her from his advances. He would not challenge another white man for her attentions because the bully will rarely challenge the kid equal to him in size on the playground. We all know that. This, however, is only the beginning of Harriet's story. So, as we know, in 1861, Harriet is living in the North and publishing a book. So, spoiler alert, we know she escapes and goes North. But the journey from the point where we are, where Harriet tells her master that she is pregnant, and to the point where she publishes her book is really perilous and astounding. So, in the interest of time, we will continue with Harriet's amazing story in episode 6. I hope I have given you the background and kind of introduced you to Harriet a little bit so that you will want to possibly hear more. Now to our big announcement. It is contest time. History's Hotties is giving away a brand new copy of Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl by Harriet Jacobs. I think this is a book that everyone should read. I think it is just an amazing story that is so educational. So if you would like to enter, please send your name and email address to historieshotties@yahoo.com. That's historieshotties at yahoo.com. There's no apostrophe before the S in histories, and we will put your name in a hat. One of my girls has agreed to be the impartial observer who will make sure all names are entered and that one name is fairly drawn at random. The contest begins on July 16th, 2011, and will continue through Labor Day weekend. The name will be drawn on September 6th, 2011, and the winner will be contacted that day. If you cannot be contacted by email, you may go to the Histories Hotties Facebook page and post your name, and we will be happy to enter you that way as well. So, if you have any questions, comments, or snide remarks, all of which we accept, please contact me at historieshotties@yahoo.com. So, until next time.